Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 273, The Mountain of Destiny, Majuba, and the Birth of a Nation. It is not a stretch to say that the defeat by the British at Majuba was also the political birth of the Afrikaner people. While the Great Trek provided the origins story, Majuba provided the validation, the sense that their culture was not only distinct but divinely protected and militarily capable of standing against the greatest empire of the age. Before the main event, there was the small matter of Skene's Hoogte. It was February 1881, and General Sir George Pomeroy Colley was in a bind. Boer patrols under Commander J.D. Weilbach were constantly harassing his communications with Newcastle. Colley was determined to act. The recent defeat at Lang's Neck had energized the Boers, and he needed to clear the road between Newcastle and Mount Prospect below Lang's Neck. His reinforcements were finally on the way, but first, he had to keep those vital British supply lines open. If you remember, Mount Prospect was a position a few kilometres south of Lang's Neck where Colley's men were based. The Boers had been quiet for a few days after the battle, but on the 7th of February that changed. A mounted patrol from Mount Prospect came under fire. Then Colley received information that Boers were breaking through towards Newcastle. The Ngorga River lay about 8 kilometres south of Mount Prospect, and the Boer commanders were focusing their attacks on this strategic point. The summer rains had swollen the river, making it difficult to cross. The Ngorga flows into the Imzinyati, the Buffalo River. The two main branches of the Imzinyati and the Ngorga River unite just below where the road crosses them, a double drift, as it was known. The two fords are 100 meters apart. It's a rocky, rapid approach that's dangerous in floods. Overlooking this crossing is a square-topped mountain called Umkhelo, as well as two areas of rising land. On the morning of the 8th of February, Colley led a force of five companies of the 60th Rifles under Colonel Ashburnham, two field and two mountain guns, and a detachment of 38 mounted troops under Major Brownlow of the King's Dragoon Guards. They all left Mount Prospect. It was Brownlow who had led one of the charges up Lang's Neck and somehow survived. Colley's men managed to ford double drift with little trouble. There was no sign of the Boers, but as they marched further south, scouts reported a large force in front behind a low ridge. The Boers had formed a skirmishing line and were being led by General Nicolaas Smit and Commandant Weilbach. The British, 240 infantry, 38 cavalry, and two of the four guns formed a squared defensive line and marched towards the crest of the ridge. There's been a bit of myth about this battle, that the British were in their red coats and sitting ducks for the Boers, but the truth is, the 60th Rifles did not wear red jackets. Their uniforms were dark green. But these were almost as bad as red on the light-coloured felt background. They also stained their white pith helmets with tea. These were now brown, much harder to see against the Natal felt. The gunners and the mounted dragoons were also dressed in dark blue, not red, but were exposed compared to the infantry as they bustled around their guns, loading and firing. The Boers on the other side of the ridge galloped forward, both sides aware that taking the summit was tactically important. Colley's two guns opened fire, and the Boers then took cover, began crawling towards the British, using gullies and dongas to avoid the artillery. This was exactly how the Zulu approached, moving low against the ground. The big difference was the Boers did not charge over the final few hundred metres. Once they were close enough, they began picking off the enemy from behind protection. General Nicolaas Smit was aware of just how dangerous the British guns were, and his men began shooting gunners one by one from their position about half a kilometre away. Meanwhile, the men of the 60th pushed forward to take the summit, but were met by a hail of Boer gunfire and suffered terribly, as Colley wrote in his report. Colley was frustrated because he realized that had he had more men, the Boer right was exposed. He could have outflanked them, but his force was too small. He withdrew the guns. There were only five men there left alive of the 25 who'd manned the guns. When Boer reinforcements were seen heading their way, Colley decided it was time to retreat. The battle had lasted from midday until almost dusk, and then a huge thunderstorm shattered the last light. The night closed in with dark clouds.
Heavy pelting showers and occasional lightning, the moon from time to time breaking through the clouds and lighting up the country in drifting gleams,
Colley wrote poetically in his report. The Boers did not attack them as they retreated. Eventually all the stragglers managed to cross the double drift. Some were swept away, but they caught hold of rocks downstream, dragged themselves to safety. When the British returned to Skeinshoogte with a burial party the next day, they found the Boers had returned too to take care of their own dead and wounded. Both sides left the other alone. The 8 Boer dead were buried on the farm Geelhoutboom, about 5 kilometres west of the battle site. The British had lost 7 officers, 66 men killed as well, and 77 wounded. Their men were buried on the battlefield, while the officers' bodies were exhumed 4 days later and taken to Fort Amiel for reburial. It had been another defeat for Colley. His men were growing disillusioned. The resident magistrate of Ikopo, James Stewart, who could speak Dutch and isiZulu, had died in this engagement. Most of the artillery officers were killed. Transvaal Deputy President Paul Creer sent a letter to George Pomeroy Colley on the 12th of February 1881 requesting negotiations. "We desire to seek no conflict with the imperial government, but cannot do otherwise than give the last drop of blood for our lawful right, for which also each Englishman would give his blood." Colley wrote back on the 21st of February, "Sir, I have the honour to acknowledge the receipt of your letter. I must inform you that as soon as the Boers, now in arms against Her Majesty's authority, discontinue their armed resistance, Her Majesty's government is prepared to appoint a commission." Both sides had agreed that some kind of royal commission would be responsible for investigating the causes of this war. That placated the Boer triumvirate leadership. Creer sent another letter on the 28th of February, 1881. "To His Excellency, Sir G. Pomeroy Colley, I have the satisfaction to inform you that we are very thankful for the declaration." He meant of a commission. Creer and the Boers were sure they would be exonerated by a proper investigation. "It appears to us," he continued, "that now, for the first time since the unhappy day of the annexation, an opportunity occurs of coming to a friendly settlement." Creer was calling for a speedy resolution. Colley never read the letter. He was already dead. His end was to come at Majuba on the 27th of February. Before all of this, the so-called Indian column reinforcements from India had arrived at Newcastle, and General Colley met with Sir Evelyn Wood, who had rushed to South Africa from England. Mount Prospect appeared safe from a direct Boer attack, and the main body of the Boers moved back up Lang's Neck, but their reinforcements continued to ride in from Heidelberg and Wakkerstroom and other districts. The British began avenging themselves. They set fire to Donnell's farmhouse at the bottom of Skeinshoogte. Then on the 24th of February, Colley left Mount Prospect with all his cavalry and 2 9-pound guns and climbed a nearby hill to get an idea of what the Boers were doing. He was spotted, but made it back to camp. The Boers that appeared on the same hilltop a few minutes later were driven off by the 9-pounders. Then on Saturday night, February 26th, General Colley left his camp again on a secret expedition. With him was a compact force of 405 men, 2 companies of the 58th Regiment, 2 of the 3rd and 60th, 2 of the 92nd Highlanders, and Naval Brigade, as well as some Hussars, the cavalry. 2 other companies of the 3rd and 60th were to leave a little later with reserve ammunition and then form a defensive position behind Colley's advancing expedition. The troops had no idea where they were going. Only after the march began did word spread they were on their way to that high hill called Majuba, to the left of the British camp. From there, they would have a commanding view of the Boer camps and their line of defences on the escarpment flats beyond Lang's Neck. The 3rd and 60th were on the left, facing a difficult pass. They all stopped at a ridge below this imposing mountain. The horses, the hussars, and the guns were sent back to the camp. There was no way they'd make it up this steep side. That alone should have been a warning to Colley. He knew he was outnumbered by the Boers, but decided to go ahead and climb to the summit of Majuba anyway, despite leaving his vital artillery behind. Colley had ordered that 3 days' rations be carried, along with 70 rounds per man. After a succession of defeats, the men began to regain morale. They were on the move. The Boer was going to be surprised to see them. Zulu guides led the way as the troops toiled up the hill in single file in the dead of night. In places they had to crawl on their hands and knees, scraping across huge dongas and clambering over massive boulders. It was a very difficult climb, and they reached the top just before daybreak on the 27th of February, Sunday morning. 6 hours of toil, but they had made it, despite the dangerous climb. To his credit, General Colley was the second man to reach the top, behind his 2IC Major Fraser. As the sun rose, subalterns pitched a tent for Colley and soldiers ate their breakfast, while some began to dig wells for water. Crucially, they were not digging in for battle, presuming that no one would be able to reach their position. They held the high ground after all. They did not set up any sort of proper parapet or dig trenches. General Piet de Beer, who was 2 kilometers away in the main camp to the northeast of Majuba, was shocked when his men ran up and informed him that the British had reached the summit. All 4 Boer camps were in direct line of sight. He had all the wagons drawn back, expecting Colley's men to open fire with their dreaded artillery. He soon realized there were no guns on the summit. Recovering from his initial shock, Joubert called his senior commanders to his side. He knew that the British, far from being in a position of power, were now trapped on Majuba. They were outnumbered by his men more than 3-1. It was time for a surprise of their own. Joubert planned a multi-pronged assault on Majuba, and soon his men rode off, taking up position on the north, east, and west sides. They spread out in skirmishing order and began to ascend the hill, while a larger group of Boers remained below, firing at any soldier who peered over the crest. The Boers had split their forces based on age. The younger men would do the fast climbing, the elders would remain below as sharpshooters. This, in a way, replicated the Zulu military technique of sending the younger men to outflank the enemy at a sprint, the horns, while the centre, the elders, advanced steadily. Joubert was determined the English should be trapped and sent another force to the south side of Majuba. They had attacked the position held by the 2 companies of the 3rd and 60th, who were carrying the reserve ammunition. Majuba was now surrounded by the Boers, and they opened fire soon after dawn at 5 a.m. That fire from below would only stop at 11:30 in the morning, just before their comrades summited. A company of the 92nd Highlanders on the north side of the crest would try to entrench themselves as the accurate Boer fire pinged off the stones, hastily gathering rocks into a kind of parapet around them. Because of this heavy fire from the Boer sharpshooters, the British kept their heads down and did not see the Boers, who were climbing towards them silently, gradually, taking advantage of the tufts of grass and bumps and the mountain to remain out of sight. 3 Boer storming groups of around 200 men each began a slow advance up the hill, led by Field Cornet Stephanus Rus and Commandant D.J.K. Malan and Commandant Joachim Ferreira. Colley was resting in his tent when he was informed of the advancing Boers, but he took no immediate action until after he had been warned by several subordinates of the seriousness of the attack. Soon, Lieutenant Ian Hamilton of the 92nd Highlanders, stationed on the perimeter, detected the Boer advance as the storming parties drew close. He reported their growing numbers 4 times during the morning. 3 of these warnings went directly to General Colley. The 4th went to Major Hay. Hamilton urged that the Boers were massing for an assault directly below his position. Colley appeared unalarmed and did not order a counterattack or reinforcements of the threatened sector. At one point, Hamilton was told to keep quiet. A Times of Natal newspaper reporter, Thomas Carter, was on the summit of Majuba and reported what happened next.
It was about 1 o'clock that a sudden and most terrible fire came from our left.
It was actually 12:45 p.m., according to Joubert's pocket watch. Ferreira's men opened up a tremendous fire on the exposed knoll. Piet Joubert later noted that the British rifles were sighted at 600 yards, while the battle raged at about 100 yards. This meant many British rounds passed harmlessly over the heads of the Boer attackers. The men of the Naval Brigade, the Highlanders and the 58th Regiment, who were defending to the left, were in a fight for their lives. 50 men against 200 Boers. They could not retreat. The ground to their rear was precipitous. They would fall to their deaths if they tried to climb down. The Boer attack was focused on the British left. The officers were yelling, "Fix bayonets!" and the soldiers firing off as fast as they could load. They began to run out of ammunition. Over the next hour, the Boers poured over the top of Majuba and engaged the British. They would not be drawn into a rushed assault and picked off the British soldiers from a distance of about 100 meters eventually. Once they took control of the high ground, they could see down into a small saucer-shaped basin that had offered shelter in which most of the reserve force had huddled. These troops, caught in the open without any fortified position, came under withering fire from their flank and their rear. The safety zone had become a killing ground. When the front line broke, the retreating soldiers poured into the hollow. They collided with these reserves already under attack, creating confusion and panic that turned retreat into a rout. Some managed to break and run towards a position a few feet away behind boulders. 4 men dropped down alongside the Times of Natal reporter Carter, who'd fallen 30 feet down the back of the precipitous slope, but somehow survived. These scrambled further down the slopes, using bits of bush to slow themselves down as they slid, but it was no use. Eventually, they had to clamber out and surrender to the Boers. The battle was over. General Nicholas Smith made his way up Majuba once the firing died down. It became apparent to British survivors that the Boers who had overcome them were youngsters, teenagers. They had the energy to climb the slopes while the elders shot up Colley's men from below. This was a revelation. Professionally trained soldiers had been defeated by young farm boys led by a smattering of older soldiers. It proved to be a major blow to Britain's prestige and its negotiating position in the treaty that would end this war. Journalist Thomas Carter was taken to Smith, who said he was free to go, but first he should help the Boers identify the dead British officers. Smith took him to a spot where the final stand was made.
There lay a body, its face covered with a helmet, but by the clothing I realized it at once. Lifting the helmet up, I made sure that it was our poor general,
wrote Carter. He'd been shot through the forehead. General Colley had perished on his last hill. At first, Smith refused to believe it was the body of the British commander.
I give you my word of honor. It is General Colley, said Carter.
Instead of celebrating,
no word of exultation escaped their lips when they learned this,
wrote Carter. They had killed the bravest gentleman on the field. One of the Boers said,
he was a very nice gentleman. He dined at my own house when he went to Pretoria.
The British losses were extremely heavy. 92 dead, 134 wounded, 58 captured, 285 of the original 405 men casualties. This, by anyone's account, was catastrophic. The victory solidified the archetype of the Boer citizen soldier. Unlike the British professional soldier following rigid drills, the Boer farmer fighter provided his own horse and rifle. Majuba proved that the practical frontier-born skills of hunting and stalking were often superior to the artificial discipline of European standing armies. It turned the veldskoen and the bolt-action rifle into cultural icons. Majuba Hill itself became a sacred site. In the frontier psyche, the mountain was a natural fortress. The fact that the Boers had climbed up to dislodge a British force that held the high ground flipped the traditional military script. It gave rise to the Boer saying, Die Berg het gekalmeer, the mountain is calmed, signifying the peace that followed their victory. The battle did more. It featured in one of the earliest Afrikaans poems, moving from Dutch to the new language of the veld. Poet S.J. du Toit was a leader of this new language movement and celebrated the victory as a divine intervention. He has the first line of Slag by Majuba, written in 1881. Majuba Korp, die wereld sien na jou nou op. Op jou het God sy mag getoon, en Engeland's trots met skande beloon. Majuba Hill, the world looks up to you now. Upon you God has shown his power and rewarded England's pride with shame. The British viewed Majuba with a mix of humiliation and disbelief, and the empire went into mourning once again. Sybil wrote a poem in The Graphic, published in London in 1881.
Oh, fatal hill! Oh, day of woe, when Britain's banner was laid low, and Colley fell with all his brave to find a cold and lonely grave.
Their defeat was so complete that Majuba entered the slang of the time as shorthand for a catastrophic blunder or a sudden shocking reversal of fortune.
One can easily imagine a modern conflict where the term might be revived in that same sense, though whether such a moment emerges remains to be seen.
Colley would never read Paul Creer's letter dated 28th February. The British Secretary of State for Colonies sent an urgent telegram later to Sir Evelyn Wood, who had succeeded Colley as Commander-in-Chief in Natal. The Secretary wanted to know if Colley had discussed peace with Creer. Wood had by now read Creer's letter dated the 28th of February and confirmed the Boers were interested in negotiating peace, but much rested on whether their leaders would be pardoned. After a little more to and fro, the Secretary of State for the Colonies confirmed that the Boer leaders would be pardoned. What happened next is for episode 274. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, tot ziens and goodbye.